Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Wealth DNA with Ron the Ronald Naraki. It's time to check your Wealth DNA so you can enjoy the second half of life. Here's the host of the show, Ron Naraki.
Hello, welcome to the Wealth DNA radio show. And let me ask you, because that's our topic today, how are you doing? How you're doing, it's not about how I'm doing. It's about how you're doing. That's what our show is about today. Today is September 26th, 2011. It's 8 a.m. in Youngstown, Arizona. And for those who have never been to the Phoenix area, you would maybe not know, but anybody that's ever been here would know that it's sunny as usual. Since it's now autumn, I guess I should start to get used to highs no longer being at 100 degrees or higher. They're starting to slip below that. But the good news is our AC bills will drop dramatically, and I can invest an additional $100 a month and hope you do the same. For those that didn't know that there's something, someplace called Youngstown in Arizona, there is indeed. It's northwest of Phoenix, right next to Sun City, and that's where the Boomer and the Babe have their studio, Youngstown, Arizona. My mentioning the weather is directly related to today's topic, how you're doing. The usual response is not terribly useful. Think about how you respond when somebody says, how are you doing? Your typical response is probably fine, how are you doing? Now, if you're from New York, the response to how you doing is simply, how you doing? You don't try to answer it. You just ask the question right back again. So reading between the lines in that question, the assumption is, I don't really care how you're doing, and I'm sure you don't care how I'm doing. That's not the case on this show. We do care how you're doing. Now, my preferred response to that question is, compared to what? I'll explain that answer during this hour. Let's take 2 minutes to define what this show is about. Not just today's show, but in general, the Wealth DNA radio show. And I guess I should remind you, you're listening to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki, and look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. Now, if you'd like to get an email reminder, you can do one of two, or actually there's even three things. Let me cover two of them. Send an email to ron@wealthdna.us. We'll keep you posted about your future shows and events we're doing. Or in the upper left-hand side of the screen, all the way at the top, there is a picture of the Boomer and the Babe. Just click the follow button under them, and they'll keep you posted on each of the great shows on this network. Now, this show, as the name implies, focuses on building your wealth and also understanding your wealth DNA. We indeed care about how you're doing. And as a matter of fact, one of the objectives of this show is to create a million new millionaires. And of course, I want you to be one of those. If you're already a current millionaire, our objective is to make you very wealthy. Now, despite what politicians espouse, and we're back into political season, it never seems like we ever left it, wealthy people create more jobs, pay more taxes, contribute more to charities and to the economy than any other segment of the population. I want you to be part of that segment. The Wealth DNA radio show, by the way, is free the first time you listen, and the cost goes down and the benefit grows each time you listen. My guests and I share the fundamentals of investing, not on what brings us commissions or fees, and we walk the talk. We do what we say you should do. We don't give advice on specific investments, since not all listeners, you're not the same as the other person listening. You don't have the same needs. You don't have the same needs that I have. On the last radio show, I shared the second commandment of investing, know thyself. And you now know after that show that not all strategies I share will fit you today, although they may in the future as your needs change and maybe the things that have been working are no longer working for you. We also don't focus on recent events or what the stock market is doing. Although, if you're curious, I do have it up on my screen. The S&P 500 is up slightly today, about a third of a percent, which, as we talked about in the past, I think it was even last week, our last show, that's pretty positive. We give timeless advice. There's no expiration date. You see, the same information I covered today would have been useful to you 20 years ago and will be useful 20 years from now. So that's what this show is all about. And that's one of the reasons we maintain an archive of shows, and that archive is maintained on www.wealthdna.us. Now, as the list grows of past shows, of course, we'll need to split that page into several, maybe by year or topic or something, probably by year. Anyway, if you're interested in knowing what I'm doing to survive and thrive in these volatile times, and trust me, these have been volatile times, I dedicated the last 20 minutes of our show on ETFs, exchange-traded funds, to share my strategy in the specific ETFs I'm using. That show, just as a reminder, is on August 22nd. You can find it on the archive, so that's just a month ago. Another reminder, during the radio show, we welcome you to ask questions. You can either do that in the chat window that's below the radio player, or, of course, you can call in. The call-in number is on the top of the screen, or let me just tell you, it's 917-388-4162. Now, before we move to the main topic of how are you doing, let me cover one topic I overlooked during the three-part series on OPM. You say, wait a minute, you had three whole shows on other people's money. How could you miss anything? Well, I did. And let me remind you, especially if you didn't listen to that series, that we're not talking about opium, that hallucinogenic drug made from jute or whatever the heck of stuff is. I don't know. I don't use it. But anyway, the OPM I'm talking about is the acronym, the letters OPM, other people's money. Now, in that series, we covered five sources of OPM, but I completely forgot to cover an aspect that applies to almost every one of those sources. It's a pretty important one. Now, to many of you, and probably that's why I missed it, it's kind of an obvious aspect, but that doesn't excuse me from covering it. So let me do that today. Take just a couple minutes to do that. Here's the message. Whenever you can, you want to use OPM in your company's name rather than in your own personal name. Let me repeat that. Whenever you can, you want to use OPM in your company's name rather than in your personal name. Okay? Now, you'll remember in the very first section I talked on OPM, I talked about credit cards and mortgages. And I mentioned that there is a short-term negative impact on your credit when you first take those loans, whether it's from your credit card or you take a new mortgage or bigger mortgage. In the long term, that impact fades, and not only fades, it actually increases your score over time as you pay that debt back down. Why? Because you're exercising your credit line, and you've shown to the credit scoring companies who have some messy formulas to show you use credit wisely. Trust me, this is exactly what happens. Your credit score goes down, gradually starts increasing, and will increase past to where it was before. More importantly than just the credit score, if you contact a bank that you just borrowed money from, let's say it's from your credit card, it's going to be most common, you're going to pay those back quicker, and ask them to raise your limit just after you've paid it back, they not only often, but I'll say almost always, agree to raise your limit. Why? Because, well, gee, you borrowed the money, you used it, they made a little bit of money, and, you know, if they gave you more, maybe they'd actually earn more money, because they know you can use your credit wisely. And the more credit you have at your disposal, the more credit you have at your disposal, the better your credit score. And again, as long as you use it wisely. And I'm not talking using credit to buy things. I'm talking about using that credit, that loan, to invest. Now, if you took the loan from your credit cards or the mortgage loan, whatever, in your company's name, you'd still have those same benefits. The exact same benefit of your credit rating, your ability to raise your credit, all of those things, as you did by doing personal. But you don't have the short-term ding on your credit score. So no negatives, all positives. I call that a win-win. Maybe it's a triple win. So when you can, take as much credit as possible in your company's name. Now, some of you say, but wait a minute, I work a job, I don't have a company. Well, then I have some very simple advice. In three simple words, and if you want, I would suggest writing this down. Form a company. How's that for simple? And start flowing as much of your income and as much of your expenses, which might be some of your investment activity, through that company. And if you're wondering why, the easy way, rather than me trying to explain all the reasons, is read Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Or even better, some of his later books where he talks about it, I think, a little bit even better. But that book is just such an excellent one, easy read, really kind of motivating. Read that, it'll become pretty clear as to why you want to have all your money flow through a company. Now, by the way, most of his books have been very, very popular, and they're available on tape or CD, so you can listen as you drive. And that's about the only way I get around to reading lately. So CD, tape, DVD, book on tape, I guess they call them, or books, book on CD, I guess they might call them, but it's always traditionally called, or audiobook. There you go. There's the word. I wish somebody had clued me in. Well, audiobook. Anyway, back to it. In forming these companies, company for yourself, I'm not suggesting, I'm really tongue-twisted here today. Okay, I'm not suggesting you set up what we call a Schedule C company. What do I mean by that? I'm not talking about setting up a sole proprietorship that you put on the Schedule C of your income taxes. Why? The tax ID that credit card will use is your tax ID. So when it puts the credit on your company, it is back on you. So setting up a company, a sole proprietorship, just with a doing business as type name, but it really all goes on your tax return, doesn't help. You need to set it up. Most likely it's going to be a LLC, a limited liability company, and you have to get a separate tax ID. You will have to have a separate bank account for that. And that's one of the reasons you can more easily then do some of your investments through that account. Now, it may take several years for that new company to become eligible for credit. So as usual, just like with investing, the best time to start is 20 years ago. So start your company 20 years ago, which I did, by the way, do my first business 20 years ago. The next best time is this week. So don't wait around and say, I'll get to it next year. You know, beginning of the year might be a good time. No, how about now? There's really no major cost to you to set up an LLC. It's very, very inexpensive in most states. Some states charge you an ongoing cost per year, like California does. Arizona, for example, does not. So generally, just check out the rules. Now you say, well, what are those rules? How do I find out? This sounds complicated. I've never set up a company. That's, you know, it can't be all that easy. Well, just send me an email. I will send you a link to one of the resources out there. There's a lot of great resources on setting up a company. And quite frankly, the SBA score we've talked about in the past, we've had SBDA, Small Business Development Association, SBDA, on this show before. They will also help you through those steps, but basically it's available on the internet. I can send you a link, a very good link. It happens to be interlinked with our main website. Now, why did I bring up this topic of OPM, and why did I bring it up now? Well, one, because I forgot about it when we had the series. But more importantly, because last week I had a great opportunity to see the real benefit of OPM, and it reminded me that had I been able to do more of it in my company's name, it would have been even better. Last Monday, our company had an offer accepted on a short sale. We submitted it, who knows, 2-3 months ago, who knows when. The short sales, there's nothing short about them. They start way back when, and you never know if or when they're going to be accepted. So we might have 10 or 15 floating out there, and all of a sudden, one of them got accepted on Monday. No big deal, because generally, you have a month to close. Well, one of the conditions of their acceptance was, we need to close by Friday, i.e., 4 days to get the money together, buy the property, or just tell us you can't and cancel it. It'll go into a trustee sale because evidently that bank wanted to clean their books up, or to some extent they want to, you know, sell off as many as they could by the end of the quarter. And guess what? We are at the end of the quarter. So what happened? Monday we get a acceptance. Friday we've got to close. Well, our company tends to be, as a real estate fund, tends to be fully invested. So unless more investor money comes in to close that specific deal, we're going to have to let this deal go. Enter OPM. My wife has been very, very aggressive recently, and I admit the banks are sending out more offers. I understand that Citibank sent out 365 million offers to U.S. Addresses for credit cards, either new credit cards or 0% offers to various current credit card holders. 365 million, that's more than there are women and children, probably includes all the dogs, in the U.S. So that means several households, and we were one of those, got more than one just from Citibank. But then, of course, Chase is doing the same thing. U.S. Bank and a number of others are doing it. So what she's been doing is taking advantage of those, especially on our existing cards. So we've taken out virtually everyone that had a deadline coming up. We took the money out of the credit card. And guess what? I had money sitting there that I could loan the company. Well, I didn't want to immediately do that. I sent out an offer to many of our investors and said, here's a deal. The good news is it's a great deal. You earn 12% if you decide to do this. It is a shared risk loan, and all of those disclosures gave them all the information on the property, gory detail. But the bad news is you need to close by Friday. Most of you that ever tried to move significant amounts of money around in 4 days, it's not easy. Wire transfer or not, if you need to move it between several accounts, especially investment accounts, it takes longer. So I started that process just in case. If an investor could not move that quickly, and it turns out they couldn't, a lot of them contacted me and said, yep, great idea, but I can't possibly get it done by Friday. So I funded that deal using OPM. On average, that money cost me probably 3% per year. I'm earning 12. Nice spread. Does that give you a little incentive to go out and get some OPM? And more importantly, if I did it in my, if that OPM were all in my company's name, my own personal company's name, or in one of the company accounts, there would be no credit dings. Okay? So there's a little motivation. That's an aside from our main topic today, but I think an important one. A real example, last week, a hurry up, buy it or quit type of situation, and we got it done because of OPM. And I mentioned Rich Dad Poor Dad. So if you have read Rich Dad Poor Dad, and you're now implementing those principles, and don't be one of those people that read it and ignore it, we'll cover some upgrades to that book in an upcoming show. You see, the book was very good. It's one of the best out there, and probably the best ever written initial book. But that doesn't mean it was perfect. There are some things you could get some misleading information. The reason I mention it is when you read that book, or if you read it recently, if you recall, you might get the impression that using OPM is a bad idea. In that book, he implies, he doesn't say it explicitly, but he implies that all debt is bad, and OPM is debt used to invest. All right, I'm borrowing from my credit cards, that's debt. I'm borrowing it cheap, around 3% on average, and some of them were 1%, some of them were 4%, but I would say on average somewhere around 3% per year, and I'm lending it out at 12. So is that bad? No. So don't get the impression from that book that everything you read is perfectly written. There are some things that need to be upgraded. I will do that on one of these radio shows, share that with you, because I think it's a great book, and with those upgrades, it's absolutely fantastic information. Now, let me remind you, we've gone a long way into the show. You're listening to the Wealth DNA radio show. I'm your host, Ron Naraki, and look forward to you joining us every second and fourth Monday. Okay, let's move on back to our key topic for the day. How are you doing? Let's stop saying fine. Let's answer that question for ourselves honestly. And on this show, let's answer it related to our finances, to our wealth. In my case, the answer would be actually in three parts. The portion in the financial markets is down about 10% this year. Not happy about that. That's the fact. That's how I'm doing. The portion in our lease-to-own real estate is pretty much flat. We're more or less breaking even, and my portion of it is more or less a 0% return at the moment, and we're still underwater on a lot of those properties. I do have a lot of tax write-offs, so it will offset a lot of other taxable gains. So that's not all bad, but it is this year around zero. Just the way the market is, people still losing jobs and those kinds of things. And the third portion that's in private mortgage loans is continuing to bring a steady income of 7% or more. Good example is the deal I just did last week will be at 12%. So that'll bring the average up. But up to year to date, I'm about 7% on most of my private mortgage loans, pretty conservative ones. Now, I might add that the strategy I'm using in the financial markets, I'm down 10%, but I believe I have the right strategy and is proving that I'm doing exactly the right thing. I just didn't have enough conviction to sell more stocks faster, buy as much gold as I should, and short the market enough. I unfortunately expected a bigger rise in the market in the last few weeks. I was expecting the Fed's announcement to at least get few people excited, maybe two of them. Evidently didn't get anybody excited. Thought we'd have an uptick in the market, an opportunity to sell more, and take that money, buy more gold, and short the market more. So that's the answer. I'm down about 10%. Am I happy about it? No, but I know I'm doing the right things based on what the market is doing. But that's the key. You need to know how you're doing. Don't just say fine. By the way, I have a portfolio board of directors. We've formed a group where we kind of consult with each other and provide each other advice. So my portfolio board of directors still believes that uptick will happen. It might be starting today, and it will happen by year end. So if they are right, I will accelerate my strategy of selling more, buying more gold, and shorting the market more. Now, if you want to know the specifics beyond that of that strategy, I actually shared that with you a month ago. All right, that was in the last 20 minutes on our show on ETFs, exchange-traded funds. I give you exactly what I'm doing. Now, again, I'm not recommending that strategy works for each one of you. I can't. I don't know enough about what your needs are. I don't know what your answers are to the second commandment, knowing yourself. But with those answers and with some ideas, you then can share that with your financial advisor and share, this is what I'm like, my risk profile, what I'm trying to accomplish, and then you can pick a strategy for you. Now, let's go back and ask you, how are you doing? I answered how I'm doing. Now, recall in January, we covered, and if you missed that, again, it's on the archives, but we covered SMART goals, setting SMART goals. And part of that message was that I have, and I suggested, you set up a spreadsheet to track your performance. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, so you can answer the question, how are you doing? Now, even if your spreadsheet only gave you the answer through the end of June, because I suggested doing it about twice a year, and that's what I'll suggest again today, at least you would know that through June, my portfolio is this. Now, again, why do I want to do that? One of the management principles I learned back when I was in multinational corporate worlds, I'm still in the corporate world, but no longer in that kind of big company roles. The principle is very simple. You can't manage what you can't measure. So in January, I touched on this topic, and I'm just getting around to giving the specifics in September. That's not fair, is it? Well, that's the hard thing about wealth building. Each of the topics is indeed interrelated. And there's no simple starting point, no clear sequence of topics. And you never know when a deal is going to come to you to use your OPM. Well, there's a pretty good chance you can find them all the time. Would have been good to air this particular segment on how are you doing in February. And yet, we had some key guests I wanted to make sure you learned from and a number of topics we needed to cover. So the sequence is less important. The fact is I got to get this message out and work with you to make sure you can answer the question, how are you doing? Now, if you missed any of those prior shows, recall there is an archive on wealthdna.us. So today I'll focus on this aspect of measuring and managing your wealth. In order to answer the question, you have to be able to measure and manage your wealth. I'm going to move this stuff around. Sorry, hopefully you're not hearing too much scratching noise as I do that. I've looked for some good and simple definitions of management. You would think, with all the books on management, so I turn to Peter Drucker. If you don't know Peter, he's often been called the father of management. Died fairly recently, a few years back in his 90s. I didn't find a definition even in his books. So whenever that happens, I develop my own. So here's Ron's definition of management. Management is setting goals, developing strategy, employing and effectively using resources to achieve those goals. Now, if you have a better definition, I'd appreciate a copy. Just send it over to me. But in the meantime, this one would probably serve the purpose. Let me repeat it. Management is setting goals, developing strategy, employing and effectively using resources to achieve these goals. That definition fits investing perfectly. You've got to set your goals. What do you accomplish? A strategy. How am I going to get there? And use employing and using effectively each of your resources, the money you have, the money you earn, to achieve those goals. Okay, so it's not a bad definition. If you have a better one or a different one, or if you found one officially in some textbook on management, that'd be great. I just wasn't able to find one. Now, in business, let me move back to the business world to give you the analogy. Shareholders invest their capital, they start the business, and they expect a good return on their capital. They wouldn't invest otherwise. They didn't do it for fun or for the excitement. They do it to make money in the long run. Then they hire executives or managers to run the business, or both, executives probably at the top level, managers later as the business grows, to run the business. And those shareholders measure the success using some key performance measures, like cash flow, return on capital, enterprise value, risk, variability of earnings, all sorts of measures to say, how are we doing? There are also some non-financial measures, and we hear more about those over the last few years than we did, let's say, 50 years ago. They've especially had a lot of media attention over the last decade or so. What are those? Some things like meeting social needs, you know, energy, the green energy, those kinds of things. And, of course, staying out of jail. Management has a tendency to get itself into trouble from time to time, get greedy. So meeting the needs of society, and staying out of jail, things like that. So there are non-financial, but usually they're financial measures. In managing your portfolio, you could do the same thing. You would say, well, I only want to invest in green energy and do the best return I can. That might be a little tougher, but it's your money, your goals. Now, in managing your portfolio, what is important to you? If you haven't thought about it, let me again suggest a goal until you define your own. But you really got to say, what's my goal? What am I trying to accomplish? Why am I caring about becoming wealthy? Is it just because I want to be wealthier than the guy next door? What good does that do if I don't have a goal, if I don't have a plan for it? So here's a goal that might work for you. Having enough money, and let me interchangeably use the word net worth instead of money, but having enough money or net worth to attain and maintain a comfortable standard of living without unnecessary risk. And that risk might be things like staying out of jail. You can, for example, do pornographic movies. That might make a great return for some people, but it might put you in jail. You could do a pyramid scheme. Again, you make some great returns, as Bernie did, but you'll end up in jail. So let me repeat that one. Having enough money to attain and maintain a comfortable standard of living without unnecessary risk. Now, there's another wording that I've played around with. I played around with a few of these over the years. Here's another one, kind of generic goal for your wealth building. And again, you want you to define your own. But how about achieving financial independence, or at least a comfortable lifestyle, when no longer employed? It's easier to have a comfortable lifestyle when you're working, isn't it? What happens when you're no longer working? So achieving financial independence or a comfortable lifestyle when no longer employed. Now, when it comes to investing, chances are you fit into one or two broad categories. Okay, one would be someone handles the investing for you. You've handed it over to a broker, financial advisor, and said, go do your thing. They've talked through what you want to accomplish, and they do it for you. That's type one. Second one is what I'll call the DIY type person. Do it yourself. I'm one of those. I don't tend to use, I use the advice of, but I actually manage the money myself. So I enjoy that kind of stuff. So one of those two things. Now, if you're in that first category, someone handles the investing for you, then when I ask you the question, how are you doing, you probably will blame your broker or financial advisor. Well, you can do that, but unfortunately, you take responsibility. You pick them. And if they're doing poorly, you need to first know about it. You need to be able to look at that and say, here, they're doing poorly. And you've got to take some of that decision-making away from them. How can you do that? Take part of your portfolio and manage yourself. You might give part of it to another investment advisor, see how they do. Any variety of things, but basically you manage your advisor. Now, if they are doing poorly, again, you need to take the decision-making away, some of the decision-making away from them. Maybe not the whole portfolio. Or you need to tell them, I want you to stop doing this. I want you to do more of this. I listen to the Wealth DNA radio show. I like Ron's ideas about having some shorts in there and being able to move in and out. and better end up with a better result as a result. Anyway, how do you know how they're doing? There's the big question. You say, okay, I'm using a financial advisor, and they tell me they're doing fine. Because when you ask them how are they doing, they say they're doing fine. That's not enough, is it? Well, you can ask them, but even better, how about measuring their results? Now, to measure the results, it's really easy if you never move money in or out of that portfolio. Let's say it's your IRAs, and you just basically are not adding more money to your IRA, and you look at the performance, or let's say over the last 9 months you haven't added any, you can look at the performance, or the total value at the beginning of the year, and compare that to today, and you see what your increase or decrease was. Then it's easy, but it's very rare we don't move any money in and out. That complicates the transaction, or the calculation of your portfolio value. Okay, well, let's say that you do that calculation. You did it for your IRAs, and they are down 10% for the year. Well, is that good? Is it normal? Or is it bad? Let me go back to what I mentioned. Remember my answer to how are you doing? Very commonly is, compared to what? What's your benchmark? Well, if you compared how that IRA portfolio is doing to private mortgage loans, the answer is it's awful. I'm down 10%. Private mortgage loans should have earned at least 4% in the last 9 months. Now, if you compare to the S&P 500, which is down 9.6% last time I checked for the year, you'd say, well, pretty normal results. I guess it's what I'd expect. So you need to know what's your benchmark. What am I comparing against? I often joke in my seminars, somebody asks me, how's your wife? I say, compared to what? And that is exactly the same idea. What's your benchmark? Not just fine. It was easy to do that calculation, as I mentioned, if you never move money in or out of your investment accounts. And that's not necessarily normal. One, because you're going to continue to invest, and you will occasionally pull some of that money out for other needs. That complicates the calculation a bit. Because you have to then use a spreadsheet and say, okay, what was the value of my portfolio at the end? I've added some money in. That somehow has to be reconciled in there. And come up with a calculation of how much it's gained or lost, given that you've moved money in it. Now, I have a spreadsheet that I do that. It tracks my own portfolio, and it does the calculation quite accurately. But I've got a lot more sophisticated software tracking my portfolio than most investors do or want to put the effort into. So what I'm going to suggest is this. John, one of our regular listeners, asked me to share a template like the one I use for doing that calculation. Now, I've had a pretty hectic schedule and not excluding, and one of the factors was, of course, that deal that kind of slipped in the last minute. But pretty hectic schedule. I haven't had a chance to get that ready. But I committed to getting it done, and I commit to you, I'll get it done. We'll get it up on the wealthdna.us website, so you'll be able to download it in the next few weeks. I'll try to have it ready for the next show, if not earlier. Now, it will give you a very good approximation of how your advisor is doing. What makes it approximate is the fact that when you put your money in or you take it out, the timing of that does affect the value. If you pulled your money out on Friday, it's going to be a different result than if you pulled your money out, let's say, on Tuesday or Wednesday last week, just because of the volatility. So I won't be able to give you an exact figure unless you've got the tracking systems in place like I do. But at least this spreadsheet will give you a pretty darn good approximation. I'll put some things in depending on whether if you get your results quarterly, for example, if you put it in the first, second, or third month, or take the money out in those months, it will give you a better result. Now, if you track it monthly, that same spreadsheet will give you, you invest it in the first 10 days or next 10 days or the last 10 days of the month. So this way you'll get a lot closer to what is an accurate calculation. But more importantly is you are then able to track how your investment advisor is doing, even though you've pulled money in and out of that fund. Okay, so it's a pretty easy calculation once you see it. I just need to set it up a little more generically so that when you look at it, it doesn't look like I wrote it just for myself, as my current one is. All right, now back to the point, there are two types of investors. Either someone manages the money for you or you manage it. In the case, either one of those, so in one of them, somebody's managing, you got to measure and manage how they're doing. But in either one, you still want to manage your full net worth, because you still have some funds, some assets that are not being managed by an advisor, or you're managing it all yourself. In either case, you want to be able to measure and manage your net worth. Now, If you're wondering what I mean by net worth, it's simply, just like the net worth of a business, it's the book value. It's your net worth is simply your total assets, everything you own, minus your total liabilities or your debts. Okay, so everything you own minus your debts. You say, well, that's pretty easy. And for most people, this balance sheet, but that's exactly what it is, just like for a company, it's your balance sheet, is pretty simple to construct. It's simple to update. And generally, and well, let me change the word generally to hopefully, it gets bigger and more complicated as you get older and invest more. So the sooner you start this net worth calculation, the better. Although you can do this with pen and paper, I highly suggest you use a spreadsheet. Forgive me, folks, because I don't want to keep using the word spreadsheet. So if you work for IBM or you use Linux, forgive me. I'll use the word Excel for short. All right, it's the most commonly used spreadsheet. Not everybody uses, but you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Excel as a spreadsheet. Now, if you don't use Excel, maybe this will make you feel better that I didn't leave you out. When I started my first version of the net worth spreadsheet, which basically has grown, but it's in place and all of the data is there, back in 1983, you ready, historians, Excel did not exist. By the way, Windows did not exist. I used Lotus 1-2-3. Great software. This is the precursor to Excel. And that's how I got to know how to use a spreadsheet. So if you're not real proficient at using Excel or whatever spreadsheet you use, this is a great way to improve your skills. Because when it comes to your own money, you're going to learn, and you're going to do it well, and you're going to continue to build on it. It's a great way to learn how to use a spreadsheet effectively. So there's a little bit of training in this whole thing while you're setting it up. The basic structure, let me just kind of now visualize this, or you can sketch it on a piece of paper if you want. The basic structure is the rows in that spreadsheet will be every asset or debt you have. And the columns will have dates. Dates as in today or yesterday or 2 weeks from now. And I'll give you a little more detail here in a second. Now, if you decide to do this pen and paper, despite my urgings to do it with a spreadsheet, leave room between your assets. Leave several lines or at least one line between each of your assets or debts because you're going to have additions over time. Those things you own and you owe today will be different. You got a new credit card offer from Citibank and you take a loan out next month, it's going to be on that sheet that it wasn't on this month. Okay. So and the other thing I would suggest is to group your assets and your debts logically. Okay. What do I mean by logically? Well, ideally, you do them by asset category. We haven't covered asset categories, and I want to kind of go through that information all today. But I'm sure all of you are pretty familiar with it. It's just that we may not have been, you know, kind of covered it in a more organized fashion. But you want to really organize by asset category. Now, if you're not sure what your asset category should be or can be, let me suggest a few. Okay, I will suggest specifics for you. So in column A, the very beginning column, set up a category for stocks, the first one. Then your next one would be equity investment funds, equity stock funds, basically. Third category would be balanced funds. The next would be bonds, and then fixed income funds. Then you would have another category for cash and money markets, but they're essentially all kind of cash-type equivalents. You'd have another category for real estate, another for commodities, and finally for durable assets. What do I mean by durable assets? Things that last more than 3 years. We'll talk more about that. Give me just a second here. All right, now, if you really want to be accurate in your asset allocation calculation, so you know exactly how much you have in equities that are, let's say, U.S. versus European versus Asian, you would then do subcategories within those of Europe, North America, Asia, South America. I will admit, I have not done that and don't plan to. It's just a lot more subcategorizing, and so many funds cover multiple categories, that gets a little bit tougher. Now, notice in my comment, I said assets and debts. I never separated assets at the top, debts at the bottom. It really doesn't matter. Quite frankly, a debt is nothing more than a negative along with your assets in that same category. And let me use the cash category. You have your credit card balances. They are a negative to the cash you hold in your money markets. If you have a car in there as an asset, then a car loan is nothing but a minus in that same category. A house loan, same story, okay? So basically, assets are positive, debts are negative on this spreadsheet, grouped together by category, because your house loan is part of your house category. Okay, pretty clear so far? Now, back to the top of the sheet. So that was the column, that was the rows. That was down the left side. Those were rows. The top of the sheet, I would also leave a few of those rows, if you will, for exchange rates. Eventually, if you're not already, you'll own some assets, as I do, for example, a lot of European assets. I've got a property over there. So you'll want to leave an exchange rate in there so you can use that exchange rate for that particular date on those assets that are in other currencies. All right, so leave a couple extra rows for that before you start. Then each of your columns will have a date in it. Okay. You might, before you start your dates, put in a column, let's say it has a short description, that this is the fund with this account number at this brokerage house. All right, so this way you've got information about that fund, how to get a hold of it, who to get a hold of. As this thing grows in complexity, you will not remember all of the details. So I do recommend maybe having a column for that. But then after that, you're going to have dates. What are the dates you'd use? Well, something like 2010, June 30th, then 2010, December 31st, and then 2011, again, June 30th. Yes, I'm suggesting about every 6 months. You say, well, that doesn't give me a feel for how I'm doing today. I could do it quarterly. Yes, but eventually, if you do it too often, you won't want to do it because it's too much work. If you do it once every 6 months, it's a pretty good balance. I've been doing every 6 months since 1983, and I'm glad I did. Now, before I tell you kind of one of the motivations for doing that, let me go back to the durable assets. Talked about cars, motorcycles, other depreciating assets you own. Should you put them in here? They're not really assets in the sense of things that are making money for you. Well, I enter them in there, and let me tell you the simple reason. I have them in there. If I go out tomorrow and buy a car, my investment funds would go down fairly dramatically. And where did that money go? It would look like I lost money this quarter. Well, that's not true. What I did was I transferred it from my investment accounts over to an asset. So at the day of the transaction, it's kind of a pretty much a swap. Now, 6 months ago from now, that car will be worth less. Not worthless, but worth less. So what I do then for a car is I devalue the car 10% every 6 months. I've tested this using a lot of different cars and various currencies, and it's a pretty good rule of thumb. If you want to go to the Blue Book and look up the value every 6 months, you can do that. It's even more accurate. But as a rule of thumb, keep things simple. Just devalue your cars 10% every 6 months. And actually, it's interesting. It's pretty logical. Then what do you do with a house? What's its value today versus 6 months ago? Well, you might want to either keep it flat for right now and eventually maybe make that 2% per every 6 months going up in value. And that's a pretty good normal real estate market. Obviously, we're not normal right now. But you can put an approximate value in again. Just as long as you're not changing that dramatically every six months, this works pretty well. All right. Now, in each of those columns, you got a date at the top. You're going to want to have a subtotal under each category. So that way you'll know, oh, in my stocks, I have X amount. In my equity funds, I have Y amount, etc. So you want to be able to have those subtotals in there. Again, much easier with a spreadsheet. You can do the same in pen and paper. If you set up, let's say, the car depreciation 10% every 6 months, the Excel gurus would know enough to stick in a column that would have a parameter, and you stick that 10% in there, and it uses a formula rather than a fixed number. And that way, over time, you can vary it. If you turn out that you've done some tracking and 9.5 is better or 10.5 is better, all power to you. Just change that parameter. So anyway, the Excel gurus, you kind of learn some interesting stuff as you do this stuff. So that's one suggestion. Okay, now, the reason I like using a spreadsheet is the key performance indicators. Voila. Did I just mention that a little while back talking about management? That's how we manage a business. We look at key performance measures. Well, one of my number one most important ones is how is my return on investment? How is my portfolio done annually? I don't measure it versus last year. By the way, here's a hint. You might want to measure it over the last 2 years. So how did I do annually over the last 2 years? It smooths some of the ups and downs that happen every 6 months and every year. Now, that bad news is, using a two-year average, you're not able to get any data until you've got 2 years' worth of history in your spreadsheet. So, why would you want to start your spreadsheet 20 years ago? You'd have a lot of history. Now, I'd like to remind you, we still have a few minutes, but let me just remind you, if you do have some questions, there's a chat area, or you can give us a call at 917-388-4162. Back to the spreadsheet. Down at this bottom of key performance indicators, one of the very key other key measures I have is I'll have what percentage of my total net worth is in each of those categories I mentioned. How much is in equity? How much is in equity funds? And how is that changing over time? Am I doing the right things? Am I, you know, is my portfolio allocation what I thought it was going to be? This is really getting back to portfolio allocation. Again, something we haven't talked about in gory detail in this show, and we will be, because it's a very, very important topic. But this way you actually know. It's not like, hey, I have a target to have 80% of my funds in stocks and 10% in real estate and 10% in fixed income. That's my target, but it turns out when you do the calculation, you actually have 20% in stocks and 50% in cash and just totally out of whack with what you thought you were doing. If you don't measure it, you can't manage it. Now, the other favorite section of a spreadsheet is much harder to do, but it is doable in pen and paper, is forecasting your net worth for your target date, the date we call T in your SMART goals. Again, January show, SMART goals. This is the date you plan to be financially independent. How much money will I have if I continue earning what I earned in the last 2 years? And then I throw in a second one, so I have two different forecasts. I'll throw in 12% per year. I say, okay, what would I earn if I earned 12% per year? And what would I earn if I earned my recent annual returns? These numbers will cross over time. It's interesting. When I plot my own, they have crossed a few times up below. You know, the 12% was over for a while, then it was under. So they will cross each other every once in a while. But it's giving you two different forecasts to say, how much money will I have on date T when I want to be financially independent? Now, after you've done this for several years, you can update that rate of return that you want to achieve in your SMART goals, and maybe you're going to have to update your T. You see, after you're financially independent, you're going to have to bring that interest rate down because you're not going to be earned 12% or probably even close to it when you're not employed. Because when your portfolio grows because of your investments, it also grows because you're putting money in. While you're employed, it's easier to put money away than it is when you're no longer employed. Chances are you're going to be spending some of that money. Okay, it's just because of the salary component. All right, now let's talk about some of the benefits. Let me get you a little motivated on doing this. It sounds like a lot of work, right? Well, part of it is you set your goals and you're managing it every 6 months. You know if you're getting to the goals you've set. So unlike 95% of the people in the world, you're going to be different. You'll know whether you're going to hit your goals. Will you be able to be financially independent on the goals you've had? And don't just go change your goals. You now set up an action plan, which might include listening to this show regularly, finding investments with higher returns and adjusting them, spending differently, spending less in the short term to hit your goal in the future. It's easier if you know where you're going and where you've been. If you don't, any road will get you there. Now, if you're still not convinced the advantages justify the time you're going to spend every 6 months maintaining, well, first of all, building the spreadsheet and then maintaining it, let me add another benefit. You go apply for a loan, mortgage loan or business loans, and the bank says, but I need information on your assets. You no longer spend days to accumulate it, you hit the print button. The work is done. The history is there. And they will be impressed with the fact that you know what your assets have been for the last 2 or 3 or 4 years, however much you print out. Trust me, that will be worth the effort. Now, in the coming weeks, just like I promised to put together a one on tracking your investment advisor's portfolio, I'm going to take my spreadsheet, the one I've been using since 1983, try to make it a little more generic, try to set it up the way I suggested, and put it out on our website so you'd have a starting point. Hopefully by year end, you don't have to develop your own, although I highly suggest it, like I said, to improve your Excel skills, or spreadsheet skills. But nonetheless, I'll put one out there as a starting point that you then can start filling in the numbers and using it. Tracking your entire net worth, and include your assets like cars and houses. Okay. Now, a big note here. I've mentioned a couple times in this show Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad Poor Dad. Great, great book. If you have read it and you're in the process of implementing those strategies, as opposed to reading it and putting it on your shelf, forgive me, because I have simplified this entire discussion today using the term net worth. When you read that book, you're going to realize net worth is not the best measure of your wealth. A better measure is your IGAs. Now, he didn't use that term in the book. It's one that I've adopted. It's your income-generating assets. It's far better for forecasting your future earnings. Because quite frankly, what your house did in earnings does not affect your ability to earn money in the future. You don't control the housing market, and your house does not earn money for you. Neither does your car. It goes down in value. It's your income-generating assets, those things, including the loans, which you're using to invest. It's how those are doing. So re-looking at your IGAs, not just your net worth, is an upgrade I have in my spreadsheet, and I will put that in as a suggested measure in the one we get out for you. Okay, covered a lot of ground today. Hopefully giving you some motivation that, indeed, if you want to manage your money, you've got to measure it first. So let's sum up a little bit of what we talked about. I kind of covered several points. First of all, the additional aspect of OPM. If you missed the early part of the show, we talked about other people's money, and specifically a aspect I forgot to cover in the three-part series, and that's, whenever possible, have your company get the OPM rather than you doing it personally. With it, I shared a little story, a very true story, very recent, as in last week, of how a house deal was done because we happened to take advantage of OPM, very cheap money, to finance a house. Now, a lot of you may not have the credit capacity, but trust me, doing what I do and continuing to use those, continuing to apply for them, continuing to pay them off, they will send you more and more and more. And if you could buy investment homes and earn, whether it's 12% or more or less on those properties, year after year, borrowing money at 3% or 4%, or even less, you will be wealthy using other people's money. So there is some motivation, real case example. Again, had I had that mostly from company accounts, it would have been even better because I wouldn't take a ding in my credit score. My credit score, I did a rough check. I don't have the finals all in yet, but it looks like it dropped by about 50 points with the amount of credit cards I took loans out on, okay? But I'm not worried about that because I know in the long term my credit score will be higher and actually start rising almost immediately afterwards. Every payment I make, principal payments, they require principal payments, no interest payments in the meantime, but principal payments. Then with that, my debt is dropping and my credit score is rising. And the main part of our show today is trying to help you answer, how are you doing? The answer is not fine. Let's get more specific. And you might want to start with the answer of compared to what? What do you want to be comparing your wealth to? Is it the S&P is a good metric? It's not a bad one. The S&P 500, or if you happen to want a world index, you might want to use the IFA index. There's a lot of different indices easily available every 6 months, if not more often, that allow you to do that. You might want to use, and I do it in my seminars, you want to use the rates on very conservative private mortgage loans as that metric. And there is no problem earning 5% a year today on very conservative private mortgage loans. So if you're not earning 5% on that portion of your portfolio or on all of your portfolio, you've got to question if you're doing some of the right things. Now, what are the steps to answering how are you doing? First, you need to measure your portfolio value and your net worth. Without it, how can you manage it? You can't manage it. You can't answer the question if you don't know what the answer is. Second, you need to calculate how your portfolio value, or both actually, your net worth has been growing over the various time periods. How did it grow this year? How did it grow the first 6 months? How did it grow versus September of last year? How has it done over the last 10 years? And that's true if your financial advisor is managing your money, or you're managing it. You still need to know that answer. And thirdly, you need to have a benchmark. It gets back to the compared to what. How are you doing? Compared to what? Decide that. I use the S&P 500 for my financial portfolio. I use a 7% metric on my private mortgage loans. And on the real estate, I look at about a 10% return long term. Now, it's going to vary a lot more, but I'm looking at about a 10% return there. All right. So hopefully each year I'm able to actually beat each of those. But there are going to be years like this one that I'll be behind on some of them. But at least I know how I'm doing. And I can look at why. What could I do differently? How do I change my strategy? How do I change my goals? I don't want to change my goals. I want to change how I'm doing. But if I don't measure it, I don't calculate my performance, and I don't have a benchmark, I can't answer the question, how are you doing? That's why most people on the street will say, how are you doing? Fine, how are you doing? Or as I said, from New York, they'll just say, how are you doing? The other person just says, how are you doing? I really don't care how you're doing, so I'm just going to ask anyway. And don't answer it, because I don't care. Well, we do care. You can't manage your wealth if you can't measure it. And if you don't manage it, your cash availability will manage you. Oh, I ran out of money. I'm out of a job. What do I do? I'll share a story with you in the next few weeks on that topic of some people that I work with. Now, I promised in this show, and the good news is I promised it, and so you'll have something available shortly, two spreadsheets to help you measure and manage your wealth, which hopefully shows you that I care about how you're doing. I'm going to put some work in to help you do what I do, and I believe it's the right thing. Again, I do it. I'm not telling you to do something I don't do. I should add a couple things. First of all, that by putting it on verbally, it will be on the archive, so I can't say, well, I never promised that. I'm on the hook. The other thing I'll add is if you had no idea what I was talking about when I said my private mortgage loan portion of my portfolio is up about 7%, which, by the way, that portion has probably had the best returns of any investments in the world this year, you need to attend one of our Learn to Earn a Higher Return seminars. I don't have one scheduled for October yet. I got to get my team together. We've got to pick a date and a place. If you have some suggestions of dates that you could make it or times that are better for you, let me know. Or I'll gladly meet with you to share an overview of what private mortgage lending is all about. You'll find out how I make money in real estate without buying, without renting, or selling properties. That means no commissions and no tenants to deal with. Sound attractive? Let's talk. I'll also remind you, our next Wealth DNA radio show is the second Monday of October. That's Monday, October 10th. Put it on your calendar if it's not already there. 8 a.m. in Arizona, 8 a.m. in Pacific time. Still, sometime we'll have a time change in there. And basically, I can say same time and same place. I got to check when the time zones change or times change in various parts of the country. We do not change our time in Arizona. Now, we haven't scheduled a topic or a guest yet, so suggestions are welcome. Welcome from you. You tell me what you'd like to hear about, what you'll talk about. If Robert Kiyosaki's book and the upgrades are a topic that's really close and near to your heart and you want that to be next, let me know. The archives of past shows, as I mentioned, are on wealthdna.us. Always available. You can listen to them anytime, including this show. So if you want to get that definition of management, you want to re-listen to how to set up the spreadsheet and get started, they're all available. If you haven't received emails reminding you of this show, send an email to ron@wealthdna.us. We'll keep you posted about future shows and events as we get the Learn to Earn a Higher Return seminar set up. We'll keep you posted on that as well. Or you can click the follow button top of the page, very top of the page under the Boomer Bay's picture. You'll automatically get email reminders about the shows on this network. So what I'd like you to do is start taking full advantage of the five OPM strategies. Hopefully I gave you some motivation for that. Do them in your company's name when you can. And start managing your wealth. Don't let it manage you. Happy borrowing. Happy investing.
You've been listening to Wealth DNA with the Ron Naraki. Wealth DNA is a Boomer and the Babe Enterprises radio production. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.